The Founders Leadership Series with Robert Thompson, Chief Executive of News Corp.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Bruce Austin, the Vice Chairman of NASDAQ and also President of the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center. And we thank you so much for joining us tonight. We have a very special guest that has joined us this evening. Robert Thompson is the Chief Executive Officer of News Corp. He's been the CEO of News Corp since 2013. But from 2008, he served as Editor-in-Chief of Dow Jones and Managing Editor of the Wall Street Journal. Previously, he was Editor of the Times and held several posts at the Financial Times. He began his career in journalism as a copy boy at the Herald in Melbourne in 1979. And he also worked at the Sydney Morning Herald. He's a native of Turrumburra, Australia. He's the author and editor of several books. In 2014, he was inducted into the Melbourne Press Club's Media Hall of Fame. I've had the pleasure of getting to know Robert over the years, and I'm very excited to have him to really talk about his long and impressive career. So please join me in welcoming Robert Thompson.
Turrumburra, by the way. That's the pronunciation.
I was wondering, I was going to ask you about that. Turrumburra. Thank you.
The Australian Foreign Minister mucked it up when she was introducing me once. So you're not the only one, Bruce.
Turrumburra.
Even okay. Australians have trouble.
It's going to be a fun interview.
I won't correct you anymore. Promise.
So thank you so much for being here. Robert is just coming back from Europe and has made the trip to the West Coast to this great interview for you guys to really share his great career. So let's start at the beginning. As I said, you began your career as a copy boy for the Herald in Melbourne. What drew you to journalism?
Well, I was 17, so I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And at that time, I had applied for lots of jobs. As there were three boys in our family, and be frank, my parents would have preferred that I do work and study simultaneously. And I was interested in computers, funnily enough, doing a computer course or accounting or journalism. And so I applied for quite a lot of different jobs. Fortuitously, I did okay at the state exam that they have in Victoria, where I grew up. And so I got into law at Melbourne University, but we couldn't really afford for me to do that at that time. And so I deferred that, and I'm still deferring law at Melbourne University almost 40 years later. And so the funny thing was I offered a job at Wormald, the security company, but it would have involved me being a security guard at night and doing part-times. And frankly, I wouldn't invest in any company that I was a security guard at. And then the Melbourne Herald rang me and said, look, you didn't get a cadetship, but we can offer you a post as a copy boy. And I thought, oh, that was interesting. And honestly didn't know what to do. And so I went to the career counsellor at my school, which is Christian Brothers College in St Kilda. And I said, so what should I do? I really have no idea. And, you know, on the one hand, maybe I can convince my parents that I can work part-time and do the law course or security guard, I'm not so sure about, and a couple of other things as well. And he said, what is the one thing of those that have been offered to you that you could never do again? And journalism was hard to get into then, and it's still hard to get into now. And I said, well, to be honest, I guess the journalism. And I hadn't really thought of myself necessarily as a journalist. And so I said to him, well, because I didn't at that stage have a passion. You know, there were some kids who edit the school newspaper at 13, and that wasn't me at all. And he said, well, maybe they see something in you that you don't see in yourself. And so those two bits of advice were so important, because it was the one thing I could never do again. Once that opportunity passed, it was really gone. And secondly, even if you don't recognise it within you, maybe they've seen some attributes that are relevant to being a reporter that have encouraged them to give you this opportunity. And so that was why I became a copy boy.
So they saw talent that you didn't
know? I'm not sure whether it was talent or tendency. I think you have to. We all have tendencies, and it remains to be seen if we have talent.
Well, obviously you had talent. So because after that, you did rise to the ranks and became a general affairs reporter, becoming the Herald Sydney correspondent. Then after 2 years, you became a feature writer for the Sydney Morning Herald, and then you became your long tenure with Financial Times, where you moved to Asia in charge of the Beijing Bureau. Tell us a little about your experience in Asia, and how did that really develop your career?
Yeah, obviously China in 1985 was very, very, very different, and as a journalist, a bit like Chinese government then regarded journalists as diplomats, and they sort of still almost do to this day, and that you could only have a certain number of journalists from each country, and it was reciprocal rights. And so with living in a compound, I mean, it was intended to restrict your access to Chinese society. But it was absolutely fascinating because China under Deng Xiaoping was starting to begin profound reforms that were changing every aspect of Chinese society and are still changing every aspect. It's hard to understand China now if you don't read about China then, actually where it's come from, because some things are really part of a cultural continuum and some things are very, very different. And understanding which is constant and understanding which is crucial in understanding more broadly China's trajectory. I did a very quick Chinese course before I went, so I didn't speak the language, which, frankly, the Chinese government quite liked. I had a translator, interpreter who accompanied me. I had a car. I was 24. I had a car driver. But I'd been a journalist by then for about 7 years. And it was a great benefit as you're trying to understand how the world works, to see how a country was examining how it should work. And having been through, the Cultural Revolution, which was 1966 to 76, and then a couple of years of stasis after that, and then eventually, technically, Chinese reform started at the end of 1978. There was a landmark meeting of the Communist Party. It really got going much after that. And so, as a reporter, you got to write about everything from the first private hair salon in Beijing to the last eunuch in the imperial court.
Wow,
And some of you may have seen the film The Last Emperor, Bertolucci film, and so about Puyi. And so his brother was still alive, and so I got to interview. So it was a magical moment in the evolution of China from old to new, from communist to sort of market socialism, and also a gradual opening of discussion. And you have to remember that for many Chinese, and there was a thing called the anti-rightist movement in 1957, where people were encouraged to speak up, let 100 flowers bloom, and then those flowers that bloomed were lopped off. And so for many Chinese, it took quite a few years before they had the confidence to realise that they could be more expressive and be more open. And you see the benefit of that now in Chinese social media. Look, China is not an open political system. There are some judicial reforms, but it's not an open judicial system in the sense that we know it. On the other hand, there is a vast amount of discussion going on in China and debate around many but not all issues that literally dates back to that period. And so having seen it then and getting a glimpse of it now when I go back was a real learning experience.
What do you think as a young person starting a career, what did you learn that was most important to you when you were there?
Well, I was lucky because there weren't many bars and there weren't many distractions. And so I was still doing work for the Australian papers, and then at night I was working for the Financial Times. And so my advice to young people is overwork but don't overindulge. Because I started out with, there were people who got cadetships when I was a copy boy, and they were smart folks, but some of them overindulged rather than overwork, and there's a price to pay for that. And the other thing, I went there with no, I always think aspiration is great. Expectation can be worrisome. And entitlement is definitely a burden and a negative. And understanding the difference between those three things, I think both as a person and as somebody starting out a company, is really, really important. And because I was thrown into a country where I clearly didn't know a lot and was forced to learn and was learning in the company. And the great thing about a newspaper is you just have to know enough to write something for the next day. Right. And so in those circumstances, you do pick up a lot. But you have to start with a certain humility because any mistake you make is very, very public. In print in those days and obviously now with digital, far beyond print.
So after your time in Asia, you did head to London to BFT's foreign news editor. And that's when you really became a leader. You had correspondents that you were managing. How did that transition work for you and as a new head of the correspondents work?
Yeah, I was given a chance by the foreign editor to be the foreign news editor, and and again, he had a faith in me that I certainly didn't necessarily have in myself because my experience was in Australia, China and Japan during the bubble and the burst of the bubble in the aftermath. And it was really as a writer and as a reporter, pretty gung-ho reporter, but the combination of reporting and writing. And so I, again, didn't see in myself the ability to manage people. And there's a difference between managing and leading, obviously. And so when I arrived in London as the uncouth Australian, sort of barely educated, surrounded, frankly, by erudite British people, most of whom, many of whom had been to Oxford and Cambridge, and you have to recognise that you're starting from a different place, both in your understanding of British society, because I'd never lived in the UK, and secondly, just in your education history that they had that I didn't. So, again, working really hard, because I didn't know. Not long after I took the job, Rwanda exploded, and so you had ethnic violence there, and I remember being asked by, and not in a perverse way, but actually in a profound way, I remember being asked by one of the senior editors, how interested should the Financial Times be in Rwanda? So it was questions, almost existential questions like that, yeah, that make you think. And then you realise if you're the foreign news editor, it's not about what I write. It's about me using whatever skills I have as a writer and as a reporter to guide. And then secondly, everybody is solitary to a certain extent. But being a foreign correspondent in a far-flung place, away from the office politics, is of itself a recipe for individual insecurity. And having experienced that, I realised that part of my job was around making people feel more secure in themselves. And so the psychological bit and the journalistic bit, there was a confluence there that unknowingly, frankly, I wasn't conscious that I could just see a need rather than I wasn't unbelievably perceptive. It was just such an obvious need that sometimes you needed to talk to someone,
right,
and just chat about this and that. And that was the best way of ensuring you had a good story the next day. And I think that's true of business generally. It's true of, I think, dealing with your clients at times. If it's just a commercial relationship and there isn't a socio-psychological component to it, it's not a very deep relationship. If it's an important client, if it's an important partner. So thinking more contextually about those connections is something that I'd advise people to do, because it was a lesson I certainly learned in that job.
Yeah, you learned that you obviously had a talent for understanding that need, which is great, which probably allowed you to get promoted. So you were promoted to
editor of
the Weekend FT, and you were assistant editor of the Financial Times. And during the second half of the 1990s, you were assistant editor, and the Weekend FT became the fastest growing newspaper in the UK. So how did you make that happen, and what would you credit to your success?
I mean, I know people say this, but it's absolutely true. There was a very talented group of people. And I think they were just looking almost to be emancipated, because Weekend FT long predated me, but it had become a little stodgy. And you could sense, actually, that people's reading habits were changing, that what you wanted to read in the Financial Times Monday to Friday, it was very different to what you wanted to do with a newspaper on a weekend. And it made me realise that the people at the FT didn't fully appreciate the potential of what they had. And so there was How to Spend It section, which became How to Spend It magazine, which is still the most successful part of, in terms of margin, the most successful part of the Financial Times group. And there was a very clever editor and a designer there who actually I brought with me to design various other things, including WSJ magazine. And I could see in him, you know, a little bit of genius and sometimes a little bit of aggro, but certainly genius. I could sense that the combination of that magazine, if you could get it going, but that you had to tell people on the newsstand, because it was a newsstand play, which is, it's hard to imagine these days because everything is thought of as digital, but that was the marketplace. How could you tell people that this was a different product, a more compelling product for the weekend on a Saturday? And so I changed the masthead, which, with the approval of Richard Lambert, who was a great mentor of mine, the then editor of the FT. Because imagine changing a masthead like the Financial Times and just putting FT. And it took off because it was signalling to potential purchasers that this was a different experience. And then How to Spend It, I had actually an argument with a very senior executive at the Pearson Group, which was then the parent company. The FT is now owned by the Nikkei Group in Tokyo. This person said to me, and I won't name and shame, I'll protect not the innocent really, but this person said to me, oh, well, you have to change the name How to Spend It. And I said, well, I think it's quite quirky in a way. It's unusual. It has a certain resonance. And this person said, well, no, you know, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing for the company. And so I avoided this person for a while so that I didn't have... Avoiding things is a great way of doing things, actually. Particularly when it's a confrontation with a very senior, someone who's more powerful than you. So I just kept on doing it and doing it, and the magazine really took off. And there was an irony and a lilt to it, and done the right way. You couldn't do it in a grotesque way. You couldn't do it as a celebration of excess, but you had to be a knowingness And knowingness is something that's very important, particularly in media, because it's about connection. And you're dealing with, I think you have to presume that everybody's smart. And if you are dealing in knowledge to the knowing, it's a very high bar. And part of it is, I've noticed it in my experience, but also at the Times of London and the Wall Street Journal, one of the key ingredients is something, I guess I call it lateral empathy, which is, it has to be different enough, lateral enough, that it's a different kind of experience, but it has to be empathetic enough that it's not eccentric. And that's certainly true of media products, and I suspect it's true of other products.
Fascinating. That's just great. So you had a great deal of success at the FT, and you were recognized in as 2001 as the U.S. Business Journalist of the Year as you launched FT Groups into America, and a great deal of success there. So as we've seen kind of the media world change and you've kind of lived through it, tell us about the transformation from print to digital and how you managed through that.
Yeah, it's still going on, obviously, and going through a particularly profound, difficult period in the late 90s. And what made me a little skeptical about some of the digital approaches was that there was actually I will name and shame the guilty this time. There was a design house called Razorfish, which was so cool and so hip. I hope there's no one here. If so, it wasn't you, but it was your elders. But and they were launching FT.com in the States, and it was, and they said, you've got two problems. It's FT, it doesn't work. It's old, it's a burden, it's a brand that's of the past, not of the future. And to that pink of the FT, you've got to get rid of that. And of course, in my current job, I wish I'd listened to them, but because it would have destroyed the FT. But it made me think, on the one hand, this is a really, really powerful thing. On the other hand, you have to keep questioning. You can't just be carried along by the current. And I think it is one of the reasons why, as a company, and look, you can search for it if you want to, but we've been particularly vocal about protecting provenance, about the destruction of the origins of content, and frankly, personally, and Rupert's the same, warning that if you do that, information and knowledge can become slightly unhinged and you end up with fake news, and lo and behold, we end up with fake news. And the commodification of content has not been one of the great contributions of the digital platforms to society. So for a long time, and I sensed it then, and I still feel it now, that I thought you had to speak up. What surprised me, to be honest, is how few other publishers were prepared to speak up, either because they were carried along by the coolness of it, which is always a danger, or they were slightly intimidated, or they, I don't know, maybe they just didn't see it. And maybe it was harder to see then than it is to see now, because now most publishers agree. And a few weeks ago, I was in Turin at a conference sponsored by the Elkin family, John Elkin, who owns a group of publications in Italy, but is the largest shareholder in The Economist and Fiat Chrysler. And it was remarkable how many people, including Jeff Bezos, who was there, agreed that the provenance had to be protected. But that was not the case in the early days when the emphasis was on eyeballs and not purses and wallets. And eyeballs are great, but they have no direct connection to commerce.
So you brought it up, so I've got to ask about it. I've got the leading CEOs of a media company. We hear a politician talking about fake news a lot. What in your mind is he talking about, and how do you respond to that as far as, you know, you guys are probably one of the ones he's calling fake news sometimes?
I think there are fake news around the election. The truth is, there's been fake news for thousands of years. I'll make up a number, 3,152 years. That's a fake number for fake news. And it's just that with digital platforms, you have the proliferation of fake news and actually the commercial incentives for fake news. And you saw the Facebook announcement yesterday about this. It's great. The president should have more important things to worry about, clearly. On the other hand, for journalists, reporters shouldn't be joining the resistance either. If journalists get carried away and if they lose their bearings during this tumultuous period, then they are doing journalism no favour.
So let's talk about your career after FT. You did, in 2007, you came to New York and you took over as editor-in-chief for Dow Jones and managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. think shortly after we met, so that was a good period. So talk about that. You went from working at the FT and managing a very successful growing business, but now you have an international news staff of over 2,000 journalists and more than 80 bureaus worldwide. How do you solve challenges in that big of an organization, and how do you manage that process?
Well, there was a great deal of skepticism about what Rupert and I would do at Wall Street Journal at the time. And I met as many of the journalists as I could. And of course, you can't promise to this or promise to that. You have to deliver. And I said, check against delivery. And we're going to invest in the paper. And it became the best-selling newspaper in the States. So I think people felt good about that. There was a plan afoot at the time, at least it was certainly discussed, to close the Saturday edition. Obviously, I'd had a background in weekend newspapers and said, well, no, let's do it differently. Let's put a big WSJ on the front. Let's do a fantastic magazine. And so the Saturday edition, we have a great team. And you need really clever editors. The Ruth Olczyk, who created the off-duty section, is the best headline writer I've ever met. She now works as part of my strategy team. Just very, very good. So you need clever people. And again, you need that lateral empathy because it can't just be another newspaper. Weekend paper in particular has to take you to a different place, has to take you to a place that's challenging to you but not alienating to you. It has to be so clever. It has to make you laugh. It has to make you think. It has to engage. And particularly the magazine, there was a plan afoot to call a glossy magazine Pursuits. And it made me think of having lived in the UK for a period, like Horse and Hound or some like Recycling Pursuits. And it was such a nondescript. So I said, it's got to be the WSJ magazine. And we should be proud of our master. We should be proud of our moniker. And so I think over a period, people began to see the success. And I think most importantly, readers began to tell the reporters. And reporters should be feisty. You know, reporters shouldn't travel en masse. You want reporters to be individualistic. You're trusting them as individuals to make objective decisions, to find stuff out. You don't want them to do what they're told, and frankly, you don't want them to be part of a cult or a priesthood, which I think is a problem for some US journalists because they see their role as so sacred that if you're sacred, are you connected to society? So staying humble and staying rooted. So we went through a lot of transition and obviously built up WSJ.com, but at the same time kept a subscription wall, which is paying dividends today. And we're in the middle of negotiations with Google and Facebook now about recognizing premium content. You know, that there should be a premium for the premium.
Right.
But one of the more interesting moments was spoke quite a lot to Steve Jobs. And we were one of the first to have an iPad ahead of the launch of it. And it was literally chained to a table because you may not know this, but Apple likes secrecy. And so and for a reason, but it was kind of fascinating that you'd go in and you tried to move it and you couldn't because it was chained. So we were discussing what should a newspaper look like on an iPad. I think the Rupert's belief and my opinion also was that it should feel like a newspaper and it should be feel enough like a newspaper that if you met your boss in the elevator going to work and you hadn't actually read the printed edition, but you had read the iPad version, that you could honestly say, if you were asked by your boss, straight at you, have you read the paper, you could say yes. So that was our test, actually.
That's great.
Because if you're on a website, you can't really say you've read the paper if you've just looked at the website, right? You've looked at the website, and you know that's a more discursive, eclectic experience. You haven't read the paper.
Right. I lived that experience. My former CEO had a two-hour commute to the office every morning and had read the paper cover to cover by the time I got to the office, and I was expected to have read the journal too, so
don't
I understand
do that. You should all subscribe, and we'll have a
definitely
special
definitely
offer for people here tonight. But we had an interesting debate with Steve Jobs about it, because Steve believed you should swipe up, and we want to create this image of turning a page, and it also allows you to put ads in, frankly, being very commercial about it. But it does give you a sense that you've read the paper rather than... And Steve was adamant, actually. No, 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 no. And then I saw him about 6 weeks after that conversation, and it had gone public. And he was quite ill at that time. And he said, no, you're right. You should swipe like that. You should turn the page. And made me... Because he was so adamant the first time, but he was so honest the second time. And I think that's a lesson too. You should, from someone who is truly a genius in what he does, and genius in understanding user interface.
Be willing to take advice.
No, yeah. Well, not taking advice. But no, that's just great. More general, not specifically from me, but no. Just more generally. It was for someone who's, when you read about him, is often portrayed as being absolutely rigid and
gotta be my way.
There's
yeah.
actually more nuance, certainly in our experience of Steve Jobs, than generally portrayed.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it was around those times when after News Corp bought the Wall Street Journal, that I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Murdoch, and they switched from the New York Stock Exchange to NASDAQ. So they wanted to be innovative, and they wanted to be on the exchange with innovative. So you guys have done an amazing job with the journal, as I said, a longtime reader. I mean, obviously, News Corp's a huge organization, and despite that, you've talked about you really valued the startup sensibility culture. We've got a lot of startups in the room. What do you try to instill with the employees and companies to really keep that culture alive?
News requires energy, it requires pursuit, it requires a kind of relentlessness, and it requires curiosity. Because a journalist without curiosity is truly a eunuch. And I think that's something that's not instilled by me. I didn't found the company, that Rupert instilled and learned as someone who took over a little paper in Adelaide in South Australia. And it is inspiring for me to see him still absolutely curious, energetic in the pursuit of something every day, never satisfied, because with satisfaction you get complacency.
Right.
And when you see that in your boss, it's hard not to understand that you should socialize that more generally. And you do. We've acquired a few companies since the reincarnation of News Corp, such as Storyful, which is one that I think we particularly have hopes for, because it uses journalistic DNA, journalistic judgment, to test the veracity of video on social media. And because you know there's a lot of falsity out there. And being able to divine digitally through journalistic instinct, through some techniques that are very, very common among reporters, and to be able to apply those skills, as well as this, the judgment of, well, now I've sourced it, I've been able to prove the provenance, is it worth anything now that I've done that? So that's another skill on top of being able to identify the origins and authenticating authenticity. But that very cutting-edge company based in Dublin has fit in almost seamlessly into News Corp. And we can see how it actually provides video feeds for Reuters, for the BBC, for Facebook, for Vice, obviously for our own properties. But most high-end websites rely on Story for that authentication. But then you think, well, okay, how else can you use that? Well, for brands around marketing, maybe somebody who's just bought a Dodge has said something online that is such a pithy, articulate recognition of the value of that product to them, through to risk and compliance, which the one thing you can be sure of in any boardroom is if you say we should invest more in minimizing risk and maximizing compliance, all the directors will say yes. So if there's a problem with a car that the steering wheel falls off and somebody uploads a video, you can send that video to the car company and say, well, you better do something about this before the trial lawyers find you. But at the very, very heart of the company is that journalistic judgment. And so I think if you acquire companies, either through merging or acquisition, you have to think, how does that culture, apart from the product, how does that culture fit into yours? And how can that culture efficaciously influence yours? Because we have traditional mastheads that need to be more contemporary. On the other hand, there are traditional values, traditional principles that we don't want to compromise.
Yeah, no, that's I think it speaks a lot to News Corp's culture that you're able to take a small company like that and learn from it and let them learn from you. So that's pretty amazing. So we just talk about News Corp is really a lot more than newspapers and newswires. Talk about your digital real estate and how it's become one of the crown jewels for News Corp.
Yeah, so I guess technically speaking, we're the largest digital real estate company in the world now. We're certainly the largest in Australia. We're number two play here with Realtor. So we were number three. We acquired the company 2.5 years ago. We overtook Trulia, so we're number two behind. We're the largest in East Asia, so Malaysia, Indonesia. And we're sort of like, depending on how you calculate it, the second biggest in India. And part of it is using the traffic that you have with the mastheads to, so it saves you a lot on marketing, but using journalistic skills to write about real estate in a way so that these sites are a more holistic experience, and that's worked out quite well.
Now, I look forward to the Friday edition of the Journal every week. Trust me, it's the first thing I kind of save it for the weekend.
The mansion section.
I save it. Well, it's kind of fun to read. It's a great story writing.
I was determined to call it mansion. There were people who were saying, "Oh, you can't call it mansion. It's crass." Well, one, I am crass, and two, if the Wall Street Journal can't own the word mansion, it's a funny story. When you think about brands, look, a brand can be damaging to you, or it can be enhancing to you. If we'd done mansion the wrong way, and the first edition had been a house in California, 15-car garage, looked like the Colosseum, that would be crass, right? I hope it's not your house. But that sort of thing. And I remember talking to Emily Gitter, the founding editor, and we were working on it together, and she is a brilliant editor. I said, well, what are we doing for the launch? Because there'd been a lot of pushback, understandable pushback, about the name. Although I'd lived in Japan, and a mansion in Japan is a larger apartment. It's not even a house.
Interesting.
So mansion means, I thought of it as something that we should do globally. And now we have Mansion Global, which has gone digital and quite successful. But I said to Emily, what's the plan for the first cover? And we went through various ideas. I said, no. And then about the eighth or ninth idea she had on the list, and it was for, I think it was for a succeeding issue, was Maya Angelou and her property portfolio. And she had, about three houses. And I said, that's it. That's the first cover of mansion. So if you go back and look, that was launch cover. And secondly, you know, she's a great person, a great poet. When she passed away, when we looked for things that she had said to the Wall Street Journal and in interviews through the years, some of the most moving things she said was in the mansion section about homes and life and what was important to her. And so you can either damage a brand, you can almost destroy it by juxtaposing it with the inappropriate, or you can enhance it by juxtaposing it with the eternal, which is the poetry of Maya Angelou.
Almost changing the meaning.
Yeah.
So for her, it wasn't a mansion, but it was a mansion. Yeah. It was pretty amazing.
It was a home.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about mentorship, which you mentioned a little bit, but you've had a great deal of success throughout your career. Who do you have you looked through as your one of your mentors, and what do they teach you that was most valuable?
Clearly, when you discreetly identify mentors, you slightly exaggerate importance relative to what you learn as a person through on the journey of life. I think we all know that, and so you have to be a little careful because it both amplifies and one thing and underplays the collective influence of people on you. So I started when I was 17, and boy, was I a naive 17-year-old. And the most important mentors you can have, I think, is in the first phase of work. And I was so blessed to have a group of women and men who were just passionate about their journalism. Because I actually got a call about 3 months after I'd started at the Herald in Melbourne from a company, and they said, we want you, because they'd initially turned me down. We've decided we want you. And then when I grew up, I played Australian football, and not to a very high level, but to an okay level. And they knew that. And I thought, they just want me for the football team. And besides that, much more important than that, I was really enjoying working with these people. So they were really, that first 6 months in the business department of the Herald in Melbourne, when you understood what work was, when you understood what work relationships were, if they'd been assholes, if they'd been unkind, if they had maltreated me and instilled in me a sense, well, look, I'm maybe badly treated now, but I'll get my chance to treat other people badly later. That sort of culture was nothing like that. And so clearly they were mighty mentors. Richard Lambert at the FT was an important mentor, and Rupert is a profoundly important mentor.
That's great. So I've known Robert for a few years now, and I know he's very humble. I mean, he doesn't really remember that he's the CEO of News Corp, a large global media company, all the time. But I'm kind of hesitant on this question, but what accomplishment are you most proud of?
Well, My family. I met my wife, Ping, who's here in China in 1987, and we were from different cultures, and, you know, it was almost destined not to work, and we made it work, and I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of my two sons. Because you know how hard that is. In a way, work is fun, right? And you should be doing something at work that you enjoy. And family is a blessing, but it's an earned blessing.
That's you have to earn every day, right? Mm. I'll ask Ping about that. So let's have a little fun. Let's play a game. We do this with each of our leadership series. It's called This or That. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and you just have to give the first thing that jumps to your mind. Give the audience a little more insight to Robert Thompson. Mountains or ocean?
Mountain with a view of the ocean.
I can tell this is going to be fun already. Send the email or sleep on it.
Wake up in the middle of the night and do it.
Cook or eat out?
My food or some of
Robert, there's a lot of these. Cook or eat out? Uber or Lyft?
Subway.
Try something new or stick with what you like?
Experiment, but be loyal.
Music on or music off?
Music off, actually.
Confront or maneuver around?
Maneuver sounds so Machiavellian. Strategize.
Early mornings or late nights?
Both.
Comedy or drama?
Good comedy.
Journalist or executive?
Journalist.
Dress up or dress down?
Dress down.
London or New York?
Turumbri.
Tech bubble or tech boom?
Tech. Ebb and flow.
Ebb and flow. All right, I'll take that one. Start something new or make something better?
Both.
Sydney or Melbourne?
Talk about polarizing society. Wangaratta, which is about halfway in between.
I'm not going to get an answer to that one.
Sydney for the topography and Melbourne for the football.
I would agree with you. I like Sydney. Know your neighbors or avoid your neighbors?
Know your neighbors.
Cautious or risky?
Calculated risk.
Watch TV or read a book?
Read a book.
And I know you'll get this one. Football or rugby?
Rugby is football.
Only for some people. All right, Robert, I'm asking one last question, and I think some of these entrepreneurs may want to meet you after our discussion, which he's agreed to say hi to a few of you. It's 10 years into the future. It's September 2027. What do you think is happening at News Corp, and what did you do to get the company there?
Well, it won't just be me if I have good fortune to still be around. What it will be is still recognizable culturally from that paper in Adelaide where the company really started, and that there will be a journalistic curiosity and a restlessness that all good journalists have. And hopefully some of the discussions we're having now around premium content and frankly paying for content will mean that we're able to invest more in journalism than now. And also in places like India, where in 10 years' time, we'll be the largest digital property company, not the second, that we will enable, both through the journalism, but also just through the sheer transparency in countries, and it's not just India, obviously, in countries that are prone to corruption and are prone to a hierarchy of privilege, that wherever you are in India, whatever your background, that you can go onto a website and know you're seeing just as much about the most important investment you can make for your family, buying a house, as someone from a privileged background. That's what I would like to see in 10 years.
Or democracy. Well, from a copy boy to CEO of News Corp, Robert, it's been a great journey. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Thank you all for being here.